A well-trained dog usually has no problem holding it all in for several hours, but when leaks start to become more common, could be a signal of a bigger problem. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back with us. So we'll start by talking about causes of urinary incontinence in dogs and how to treat those problems. Sandy's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And then we'll talk about why you still need to be thinking about protecting your dog from ticks, even in the middle of winter. And, of course, we'll be answering all your pet care questions. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Great to have you with us. How common a problem is urinary incontinence in dogs?
Well, we know that in female dogs, it affects about 1 out of 5 female dogs.
That's pretty high.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, the big problem we have, first of all, is determining, is this truly urinary incontinence, meaning that it's passively, the dog is just leaking urine out. And those dogs are usually either just walking around and dripping urine, which is pretty obvious if that's an issue, or they lay down and get relaxed and they may wake up with a wet bed. And it may be a small amount, could be a larger amount. And that we have to determine whether that's going on or whether the animal's just having accidents because maybe they have urgency where they can't get outside because they have a urinary tract infection, or maybe the owners didn't get home in time, where they're actively squatting to go to the bathroom, and, you know, it's not in an area where they're normally sleeping or relaxing. And, you know, just lack of housebreaking is, you know, something we have to determine as well. So there's, we have to look at, is this a behavior problem or a medical problem due to something else versus this incontinence where the urine is just leaking out? And so when we get these cases, the first thing we always do is we have to do a physical exam and, you know, just get an idea of what's going on with the dog and really get a good history as well. And a veterinarian is going to first of all ask the owner to, we have to have a urine sample check because we want to make sure that this dog doesn't have a problem with a urinary tract infection. We also usually get a little bit of blood work to look at some key things that could start pointing us in the direction that maybe this dog is drinking a lot of water for some reason. So the urine may help show us, you know, hey, your dog's a diabetic, and so they're drinking a lot and urinating a lot, and maybe the bladder sphincter just can't hold back the dam, or maybe they have kidney disease or Cushing's disease. So we always want to rule out a medical problem first. And one of the things that's really helpful before you go into your veterinarian is to do water consumption studies. And it's so simple, but it's so much, it gives us as veterinarians so much information. What I mean by that is, if you, and this really only works if you have one bowl per animal and you know which animal is drinking out of which bowl, is putting a measured amount of water in the bowl. And anytime you add to it, you keep a tally. And anytime you dump it out, you keep a tally of what you've wasted. So at the end of 24 hours, we know how many milliliters, ounces, cups, you put it in any unit you want. We can always convert it to something that's useful for us. That's always a very helpful bit of information to have when we're starting to work up these cases.
So, okay. Yeah. Cats, do they have a problem?
We don't see it in cats. It can happen. And when one of the things that we can see that can cause urinary incontinence is sometimes some anatomical problems, like the cats that are in the classification of Manx cats, which are the tailless cats, will sometimes have some spinal cord abnormalities that can affect the nerves going to the bladder. And we can see incontinence, not only urine, but sometimes stool incontinence with that. I had a bulldog. My very first bulldog was born with a lot of birth defects, including not having a bladder. I know that sounds very strange,
wow,
but she was born with one kidney, no bladder, and that was why she presented to the vet school to say, what's going on here? Does she have something that can be fixed? And it wasn't fixable. And so she ended up, in those cases, just like with the Manx cat, probably nothing medically that we can do to correct that. It's more management, and that's where you get into diapers and things like that, is not impossible to do. They have so many different commercially available available diapers now for dogs, and that you can modify for cats as well, that it does provide them with good quality of life and the owner with better quality of life because you're not dealing with a soiled house all the time.
Yeah, and in terms of surgery or anything to...
First of all, before we start jumping to surgery, we usually try medical management. And there's kind of two different pathways that we take. There's one drug called phenylpropanolamine, or it's also called PPA. Most owners that have a dog that's incontinent will see the name Proin on the bottle. There's other brands as well. And what this does is it selectively tightens that bladder sphincter. But unfortunately, one of the side effects is hypertension. We don't see dogs becoming hypertensive very often, especially when they're young. It's usually an older dog thing. So if we've got a dog who develops urinary incontinence when they're getting towards their senior years, don't be surprised if your veterinarian isn't checking blood pressure before starting your dog on this particular medication, because if we raise the blood pressure, that could cause a whole set of new problems for the pet. The other class of drugs we use are the estrogens, and there's one that's actually licensed for dog use. It's called Incurin, and it's a daily product that we use, very safe. And then we have one that we go to formulating pharmacies for called DES, and that's used a little less frequently. We usually give a loading dose for a few days and then often get into maybe once a week treating the dog. But anytime we're using estrogens, we always worry about the bone marrow. So when we have dogs on medical management, we may need to be checking blood cell counts and so on periodically while they're on the medication. So it's not foolproof. It's not a magic cure that is, you know, we're not going to see issues with. And throughout the dog's life, medication may have to change as well. But there are a couple of surgical techniques, and there was just an article published, and I've had one patient that had this done. They actually went to Purdue University to have this procedure done, where they actually put in an artificial bladder sphincter. It's a little ring that goes around the outside of the bladder sphincter and has a little hose attached to it with a port under the skin where you can pump up air into it to allow that thing to be tightened around the bladder sphincter. And I mean, this is obviously major surgery to have something like this done. You have to travel, go to a specialty clinic. But that is something, especially for dogs that aren't responding well to medical management. And this little pit bull definitely did not respond to medical management. She was on medical management, and we still had to think about doing this. There's another surgery that's called a pelvic sling, where they attach the bladder down so that it makes the sphincter a little bit tighter against the pelvis, and that will help some dogs. And then there's also a method, and I've never seen this done. I don't know anybody at the vet school here that's doing it, where they put collagen injections around the sphincter. So all of these are kind of specialty treatments that I, you know, as a practitioner in veterinary medicine, I would not be comfortable doing. You're looking at probably going to a specialist. But if you've got a leaky dog, you know, get them in, make sure their bladder's full so we can get that fresh urine sample. Do a little water study so you can walk in and say, here's what my dog takes in every 24 hours. And don't be surprised if you have some medical workup done before your dog gets put on any medication.
Lots of callers online. So let's go to the phones and to Carol first in Oak Creek. Carol, hi.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. I'm so desperate about my 16-year-old cat. She was just diagnosed with hyperthyroidism. Mm-hmm. Her T4 levels are four times more than they should be. They're at a 16.
Oh.
All other blood work is good, but it is impossible to give her a pill. So last week, I started her on the Hill's YD thyroid care diet. I've been slowly introducing it as of last week, but she really hates this food, wet or dry. I asked the vet if radioactive iodine would work, but he feels that she's not a candidate for it. She only weighs 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if I have any hope left. Do you think I need to give her more time with the Hill's food, or, you know, and how much time should I do the transition? I don't want her to starve to death, and I'm
right,
so worried.
Right, right. And when they're that frail, that's one of the big concerns we have with that diet. There's multiple ways of treating hyperthyroidism in cats. Just to back up for a minute, this is probably one of those, like, almost like an epidemic that we're seeing, and I don't know whether it's because we're just getting better at diagnosing it and recognizing it, that when we see an older cat that's frail to start evaluating the thyroid levels. But cats are prone to getting little goiters that are active in their thyroid gland that produce thyroid hormone. And the thyroid hormone is involved with metabolism. And it's kind of like the gas pedal of the car. And so you can imagine what your car would be like if you were always like just flooring the engine. Eventually, you wear the engine out. And in this case, what we find is that the heart becomes an issue. We usually have these cats have heart murmurs and can die of heart failure without treatment. They can eat a lot but still continue to lose weight because they're in this hypermetabolic state. So once we have a diagnosis, the treatment usually I've had one cat that I used the diet on because it was a cat living by itself and he actually liked the diet. This is a really low iodine diet, and the problem with using it is that they can't eat anything else. Even just getting treats is enough to throw off how that diet works, and so you have to be quite strict with using it. And if your cat isn't eating it, then the next step is using methimazole, which you mentioned that your veterinarian had tried to give your cat a pill. You can get, that is one of the drugs that you can get formulated into a bio gel. It's a gel that goes on the inside. We usually, the place we put it is usually on the inside of the cat's ear, a place that they can't groom readily, that has lots of superficial blood vessels. So the skin is very thin there. And so instead of medicating with a pill, you just use a little dab of this ointment that's in pre-measured syringes. You can get it. Our pharmacy just puts it in a syringe, has people get little finger cots or rubber gloves, squirt the measured amount that you need for your cat on the end of your finger, and morning and evening wipe it in alternating ears.
Could you spell methimazole for me?
Methimazole? Okay. It's also called tapazole. That may be what your cat was on. But methimazole, and I have to write it out because I'm a horrible speller. It's M-E-T-H.
Okay.
I-M.
Okay.
A-Z-O-L-E.
Oh, okay.
And that's probably the medication that your veterinarian tried. Ask your vet if they don't have availability of the bio gel that you can get, if they can go through a formulating pharmacy. There are many pharmacies that can make this for you. Our pharmacy, because we're in a big hospital, we make it ourselves, but many people in private practice will actually go through, we have a formulating pharmacy in the Monona area here in Madison. There's one in Milwaukee, Chicago area. They're all over, and they ship it to your house, but it's a prescription product, so you'll have to get your veterinarian to write a prescription for you. But I find that for the majority of owners that have trouble pilling their cat, that works wonderfully. All you have to do is have the cat sit in your lap. They don't mind it. It works very well. It takes about a week longer to reach therapeutic levels than it does the tablets. But I tend to see fewer side effects than with the tablets. Tablets, some cats will vomit with it and get some GI distress. So the gel seems to be a little bit better that way. Your question as to whether your cat should go through radioactive iodine really depends on you and your finances. Your cat is 16 right now, could potentially live much, another 2, 4, maybe 6 years with appropriate care. And you have to weigh out the benefit of having your cat have radioactive iodine done, which is just they give an injection of radioactive iodine. They have to stay in a licensed facility with very limited human contact. We have technicians that have to, wear special shielding and so on. They stay in there until their radioactivity level drops down low enough so they can go home safely. And it's usually 3 or 4 days in the hospital. And there's a couple of places in the state that are able to do this. So, but you're looking at probably $1,200-$1,400 to have it done. And for your kitty, that may buy a lot of medication for that period of time. So we also have to look at, does your cat have any other underlying diseases like kidney disease, which can be an issue for these cats that are hyperthyroid. They often go hand in hand. And if your cat already shows signs of some kidney disease, then radioactive iodine may not be the best interest for the cat.
There so, we go. Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn's guest says social isolation is a growing epidemic, one that's increasingly recognized as having dire physical, mental, and emotional consequences. And they'll talk about that at 2 o'clock today. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Back to the phones and to Mary in Wauwatosa. Mary, thank you for waiting.
Hi, doctor. I have three delightful cats. They're treated by a vet in my area who I think is very holistic. She recommended I feed them only grain-free canned food, never dry food. She said if you give them dry, there's sugar in it, and in order for it to kibble, there has to be sugar in it. So in order to control their weight, she's got me, I feed them Merrick or Freedom, something like that. Well, in the last couple months, my youngest cat, who's almost 4 years old, started having some serious dental issues. So they looked at his food and really thought things through. A friend of my husband's also is a vet, and he believes that cats also need dry food for their teeth. And I want your position on dry versus canned, and do you never feed them dry, and what do you recommend?
Yeah, I think a very good question. You know, cats being carnivores, it does, to a degree, make sense to avoid feeding them a lot of like vegetation type material. But, you know, if, and I'm kind of hemming and hawing here because even canned foods are going to have often some form of starch in it. Dry foods have to have some form of a starch in it to be able to hold it together when they're manufacturing it. It would be impossible to make without having something. So just because a dry food says grain-free doesn't mean that it doesn't have some type of starch. It may not be corn or wheat or soya, but it may be peas or potatoes or something, which nutritionally, if you cook either of those things, they're about equal from the nutritional standpoint. My personal preference is I like to see cats get a little bit of both. And the main reason why I like to see them do that is the canned food, a little bit easier to digest. It's going to have less of the starches and things in it that you're going to have in the dry food. It's going to provide them with more water. And then many cats, as they get older, have diseases that require them to drink, have more water going in. And if they're not used to eating canned food, that could become a problem, especially if they have to go on a therapeutic diet that would work better in a canned formulation. The dry food, obviously, you are going to get more dental care. And so if you're feeding only a canned food, you do have to get into brushing your pet's teeth. And that's, I think that's where maybe your veterinarian maybe fell down with not saying, okay, canned food, great idea, but here's the pay, you know, the payback is you need to have a toothbrush handy and be brushing your cat's teeth daily to be able to keep their mouth healthy.
I use greenies.
Yeah.
I give the cats greenies.
Yeah. And I think greenies are one of the treats that are approved by the Veterinary Oral Health Council. There's a very good website that is called VOHC, stands for the Veterinary Oral Health Council.org, that has all the listed products that they have shown through looking at research. They don't do the research. They evaluate the research from the companies, say, yes, this is a product that works. And it breaks it down into dog products and cat products. And you are going to find that there are some dry foods there that are dental diets, as well as treats and things like the greenies that are very helpful. But remember, those greenies are only going to be helping where the cat is chewing, which are those back teeth and not the front ones. And so you may still have to consider brushing some of those front teeth as well. Although we don't tend to see a lot of dental disease up there. Most of the serious stuff occurs back further in the mouth with the premolars and molars. So so I like to see a mixture. Back to that again, I like to see both canned and dry fed. measured amount, meal fed, so we can control the caloric intake that the cat's getting.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Yeah, appreciate the call, Mary. On to Bill in Madison next. Bill, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. This last May, April, I applied a product called Vectra 3D for ticks and fleas on my two pit bulls, Louie and Ye, 5 and 9 years old, and it ended up killing both of them.
Whoa. That, you know, Vectra 3D is recognized as being an extremely safe product. It does have it's got a couple of ingredients in it, one that controls fleas and kills fleas, the other one that controls ticks. It's permethrin. It needs to be used at the correct dose for the dog. That's why it comes in various tube sizes.
Right.
It is very similar, just makeup-wise, to Advantix that you can buy over the counter as well. But this is only available through veterinarians. A few questions that I have for you.
Okay.
One, did you report this to the company?
My veterinary, Oregon Veterinary Clinic, did. They offered a $500 if I file a quick claim certificate. Have it notarized, they would send me $500 for my two boys.
Did they do an autopsy on your dogs?
No.
Okay. You are going to have a hard time proving that that was the thing that did it. How long after you applied it did they die, and what were their symptoms?
They had IMHA, their red cells. Their body was killing off their red cells.
Yeah,
They both had over 5 transfusions each, much blood work. Even the university, I took them out to the emergency animal hospital.
Did they get vaccinated?
That's the money I spent on them.
Yeah, did they get vaccinated about the same time that this happened?
No,
they didn't. Okay. Because I have never seen immune-mediated hemolytic anemia being caused by topical application of flea and tick products. We do see it as an autoimmune problem that can just occur spontaneously. It may in rare, and it is an uncommon disease, but can occur when they've been exposed to foreign material like vaccines. We know that that can be one of the triggers. And it can be a disease that they can go into remission and never look back. In other cases, it can be quite severe. And I'm just very, very surprised that because this is not something that I teach flea and tick products and their side effects and so on, and this has not been reported. The one autoimmune problem that we have seen with some flea and tick products, not necessarily Vectra, is what's something called pemphigus foliaceus, where at the application site, you get a really nasty skin irritation, and that's been found with one of the chemicals called Amitraz that's been in some of the flea and tick products. But I still would be recommending, if you have, in fact, national guidelines right now for controlling heartworm disease in really heavy endemic areas, is to consider using Vectra 3D as well as your heartworm preventative, because it's one of the few that are licensed to prevent mosquitoes from biting, and that's the insect that transmits heartworm to the dog. So it's kind of a double way of approaching heartworm disease. And so this just came up at the American Heartworm Society meeting, and it's been in all our journals. And so this is a product that is really recognized as being safe, and I'm so sorry that you lost your dogs. I would just have a hard time linking those two, and if they were related, or pardon me?
They are not related.
They weren't related. Yeah, it's just such an oddball thing. But I would be going back and looking at everything else that they may have been potentially exposed to, even in the couple of months prior to developing this autoimmune condition. Any vaccines, any new medications that may have been given orally, anything like that, versus what you've applied topically.
Yeah, It's really
Oh, my goodness.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Product tested and make sure that it's what it's supposed to be, that it wasn't a bad batch.
And, yes, and I would assume that the company would probably want it back to be able to do that.
Now, they haven't contacted me about anything.
So this is an extremely rare occurrence, and I'm very sorry, but I don't think we can blame the chemical.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah.
It's really too bad. Bill, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have other callers online, and Stephen in Madison has something for us, and so we'll go there next. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
What can we do
Dr.
for you?
Dr. Sandy. Well, I have two terrier dogs, both about 8 years old. Both of them rescues. I got the first one when he was about a year old and kept him for a couple of years by himself in my home. He's about 18 pounds, terrier mix. And I decided to get him a friend. And so we found another rescue dog that some people couldn't keep anymore, and we adopted him. And both of them are neutered males, and he was the sole dog in the household that he came from. And they don't really like each other.
Oh.
And which probably has something to do with what's going on. We're seeing some marking, particularly of the refrigerator, of places that you might associate with me, like my desk, so they don't. And all the marking is from the new dog.
Yeah.
But the refrigerator is the big thing, the most common thing. And it didn't start right away, and the only thing I can think of that may have changed dramatically was the new dog decided he was comfortable enough to start sleeping in the same bed with the other dog and myself.
All right, right.
And because that's right about when it happened, and also I would notice that it would happen the very next day on the occasions that it happened. But now he's a little more comfortable, and, in the middle of the night he joins us, and then a couple of times a week I'm discovering places that he's marked.
Yeah, this is a tough one to deal with because, obviously male dogs that are intact will urine mark for marking their territory, marking to leave their calling card behind for a girlfriend. These guys are neutered and really make sure that they're neutered. It would be really rare to have a dog that is bilaterally cryptorchid, meaning that retain testicles. So look at veterinary records to say, yes, you are neutered. You can do some hormonal testing just to make sure that there isn't a testicle hiding there that that you just don't know about, that may be in the abdomen. When we see neutered male dogs that maybe are just socially not getting along, it's usually the dog that is kind of a little less confident, maybe, leaving their calling card behind. And I kind of look at it as, if they could work a can of spray paint, they would mark everything mine, mine, mine. Okay. But they can't do that. So what do? They use the next best thing, urine. So working with a behaviorist that could perhaps, help you evaluate the social interactions with the dogs just to see if maybe, you're doing something or maybe changing things like providing extra dog beds or resting areas where there isn't going to be any conflict may be very helpful. But often what we end up coming down to in these cases is putting a belly band around the culprit, meaning you can find them if you just Google belly bands. They're a little cloth strip that goes around the dog's abdomen so that when they do lift their leg and urinate, it goes into an absorbent pad rather than on your refrigerator or on your desk. Sometimes we've had some success with using psychoactive drugs that help boost the dog's confidence or help with anxiety. But again, this would be something that I would want to get a diagnosis before you start prescribing medications to see, are they anxious or what's happening that way? One thing that won't hurt is using a dog appeasement pheromone in a collar form. I've had a one case where the owner said as soon as that collar gets to be 30 days old, the dog will start urine marking again. So she, like clockwork, puts a new one on the dog every 30 days, and that's controlled it. And it just has kind of a natural calming effect. So that might be something to consider trying. But these are tough cases. I live with three boy dogs, and knock on wood, every day that I don't have this as an issue, because it can be quite common in, you know, when you have a herd of boys together.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Good luck. Thanks so much for calling. Dan in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon, or good morning, I'm sorry. I've got a 13-year-old lab shepherd mix who's, I'm going back to this topic before, was starting to pee a lot. We took in a urine sample, and they did a blood sample, and liver's good, kidneys are good, no diabetes. The vet had mentioned that he's got high calcium, and that could be due to parathyroidism. Yeah. We're taking him in this coming Thursday for another blood test.
Okay. Well, the body is very good at regulating calcium and phosphorus, and there's a gland in the neck called the parathyroid gland that controls this, and sometimes we can see nodules or tumors of the parathyroid gland, and the blood tests that I assume that your veterinarian is going to be doing is they're probably going to be sending off a blood test for looking at what's called PTH, parathyroid hormone, to see if that's elevated. If that is, then probably an ultrasound on your dog's neck to identify which parathyroid is enlarged so that it can be surgically removed. These dogs usually do fairly well after surgery. We often have to monitor them in critical care and sometimes have to administer extra calcium if their body goes the other direction and starts not having enough calcium in their body. The other thing that they will often be testing for and going back and just redoing their physical exam from head to toe is looking for some type of other type of cancer. Probably the most common forms of cancer that can produce a hormone that mimics parathyroid hormone is called PTHRP, which is parathyroid hormone related hormone. Or related protein, I should say. That's what the RP stands for. And they usually do that together. And when we see that, then we start looking at, does your dog have lymphoma? Or does your dog have a mass in its rectal area that could be doing this? That's where one of the common tumors often occurs. And so when I get an elevated calcium level back, I immediately go back and redo my physical exam, palpate every lymph node, anything that's even slightly enlarged, I'll do a needle aspirate of, to look at the cells. I'll do a rectal exam to look for any lumps or bumps. We'll often take chest x-rays to see, because sometimes you may have lymph nodes in the chest but not externally, and undo an abdominal ultrasound to look for tumors or enlarged lymph nodes or other cancers in the abdomen. So this can be quite a involved workup, but you do have to do it fairly quickly, because the longer your dog stays in a hypercalcemic state, you start running into issues with kidney failure, because the kidneys start to mineralize. And it can be a real problem for the dog's body. So I'm glad you're getting in right away. But when you're in there, ask your vet to redo the physical exam and start looking for everything else, because it takes a few days to get this blood work back from Michigan.
Now, they did do a digital rectal exam, and they checked his prostate. If there was another growth in there, would they have been able to feel?
Yeah, most of the time when you're in there, besides just putting your fingers straight in and feeling for the prostate, you kind of do the clean sweep where you start at 12 o'clock and run your hand all the way around and then backhand it all the way back up again to see if there's any lumps or bumps in the area of the anal sacs. So those would be, I would assume that was done as well. But have them recheck all the lymph nodes while you're in there getting that blood sample taken.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. Good luck to you. Jane emailed to say her cat's vet suggested giving aloe vera to act as a stool softener, but both the ASPCA and the Pet Poison Helpline list aloe vera as toxic to cats. Do you consider it a safe option?
No. I'm not sure where that came from. I typically would not be recommending using something like that for as a stool softener. My favorite one to use, which is available over the counter, is a human product called Miralax. It's a tasteless powder that you can mix with a little bit of canned food. We usually start at about a quarter of a teaspoon and then gradually increase it until the cat starts producing more comfortable stools. Sometimes they need to have an enema done just to get things rolling in the right direction. But I'd also be looking at, why is your cat having trouble passing stools and needs a stool softener? There's usually some underlying medical problem, like their kidneys are not working right, or they're hyperthyroid and it's throwing off their water balance, or they're diabetic. So sometimes it does involve doing a little more medical workup to see what else is going on there to cause your cat to produce dry stools.
Sarah in Appleton, we turn to you next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. I am calling because we are considering getting a dog this spring. I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, two sons and a husband. None of them have ever had a dog in their life before, and I grew up with a dog and absolutely love golden retrievers in particular. I'm just wondering if you can recommend any books or other resources that would be good for my kids in particular to start getting them into the mindset of what they're going to need to do to be responsible dog owners and trainers and sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think your kids are probably too young to be doing this on their own. I mean, this is obviously, you're going to need, they'll need lots of parental support on your part.
For sure.
But I would be recommending that you may want to look at your local 4-H groups. I know that back when my daughter was in the 4-H age, we did have like dog projects and so on, and that was a very helpful thing for a lot of children. I was involved with her group. There are some dog training facilities that call themselves family dog training, where they want family members to all be involved, and so they want everyone to come there, although only one may be working with the dog. Everybody else is on the same page and is learning at the same time. And so either seeing if you can, calling some of these training groups and just saying, hey, can we sit in to see what's going on, just so we have a little bit better idea how to be able to do this. And that may be helpful. When it comes to books, boy, my brain has just gone.
One that comes to mind, at least on the adult level, is Patricia McConnell's The Other End of the Leash.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Oh, okay.
Any of her books are great. There's one that's called The Puppy Primer that she wrote as well.
Yeah.
And that's a nice, easy read that would be very suitable as a family read aloud book that I think, and you can still get that at bookstores and online
order it
and
from
so
her.
On. Or right, order it directly from her. Yep.
So. Okay, great. Yeah, I know that I will be the primary trainer and caretaker of the dog, but I really feel strongly like I don't need three people working against me.
And that you are so wise to be looking into that right now.
Yep.
Awesome.
Well,
great.
Good luck
Thank
with
you.
The puppy.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. And more callers online. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. And if you have a health question for you about your pet, I hope you'll join us. And if you've got a pet photo, it's one of the things Sandy and I always enjoy seeing are the photos that are sent in of pets. So if you've got a pet photo, I hope you'll post it on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And you can post your photo and a question there as well. Let's turn to Mark in Oshkosh next. Mark, thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. About over a year ago, we adopted a cat that was in the neighborhood roaming and for about 3 years. A little over a year, we were able to convince him he should be an indoor cat. So about 2 years, 2.5 years ago, I noticed his front lower canine was broke off. And he doesn't seem to favor chewing on one side or any pain when I rub his lower jaw. So I'm just wondering if I should have that looked at. It extends about, eighth of an inch above the gum line.
Well, with it fractured like that, that tells me that it's actually in the pulp cavity, and the pulp cavity is exposed. And we know that when that happens, the outside world can get down into the center of the tooth, down to the root, and cause a tooth root abscess. And even though the cat may not be showing pain, remember, cats and dogs are very different than us. We love getting flowers and sympathy cards and pats on the back about, you know, oh, you poor thing, you had to go into the dentist and have a root canal done or whatever. For cats and dogs, they know that if they complain and show signs of discomfort, they may be picked out as being weak and could potentially be somebody's lunch. And so it's this natural preservation response to not show pain. I would definitely recommend having that tooth looked at. What you see of the tooth when it's intact, and it's the entire tooth is there, is only about a third of the tooth. About two-thirds sit down in the bone, and if you do get an abscess starting down there, there really isn't a whole lot of bone surrounding that tooth. So if you lose a little bit, you can really affect the integrity of the mandible. And I've seen cats end up with mandibular fractures from something like this, and now it becomes a huge issue to try to hold everything together and get this to heal appropriately. So the sooner you can get this kitty in to be looked at, have some oral x-rays done, if there is no indication of infection on x-rays, and so the bone around the root of the tooth looks like it's healthy and happy, then they can do a root canal cover the tooth up so that the cat can still have that tooth there, and it will help with maintaining just the integrity of the jaw by staying in place. So this would be something that, depending on the level of where you want to go, you may want to consider visiting with someone who specializes in veterinary dental care versus your regular veterinarian, although any veterinarian is capable of being able to do this kind of dental procedure. Not a root canal, but extractions and so on, that is always a possibility.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. Carol in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a suggestion, something that worked for us, for a solution for constipation in cats. We have a cat who's had chronic renal failure since 2011, drinks a lot of water. And last August, he was throwing up a lot and not wanting to eat. And we took him into the vet, and they were kind of acting like, oh, you poor people, you're not really facing up to the fact that he's not long for this world. And they try to feel to find his kidneys, and there's like real super tiny nothing of kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
And so we brought him home, and a few days later he passed an extremely large turd.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what to call it.
Yeah.
Anyway, he screamed and yelled. It must have hurt a lot. And then he ran and hid under the bed. And then after that, he seemed to have his appetite, and he seemed to be feeling better. So my husband, who has been taking Benefiber, decided that when he mixes up his Benefiber, he puts a little on the wet cat food, about mm-hmm. a couple tablespoons. It's quite wet.
Yeah.
And the kitty likes to lick up all the liquid before he even starts eating the food.
Mm-hmm.
There's no taste in it or anything, so he just goes right after it. He's used to drinking a lot of water and everything anyway. And now he's got no more constipation issues, and he's got larger feces,
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing. And I'm so glad that happened for your cat, because what happens when cats have kidney disease is they walk that tightrope of hydration, and all they need is a day where they may not take in as much water as normal, and then their body will start to pull moisture from wherever it can, because regardless of how much they take in, those kidneys are going to continue to pump out urine, very dilute urine, and then the cat cat gets dehydrated. And so he probably pulled a lot of moisture out of the fecal material, made a, you know, made it difficult to pass. And that would have been something that potentially could have been palpated in the abdomen. Sometimes when we have kitties that are acting like this, we take an x-ray to look at how much stool is actually in there, so we kind of know how much to be watching for in the litter box. Doing an enema is sometimes helpful to help with softening the stools. You have to be really careful with giving enemas to cats. There are some that are available for people that are quite toxic for cats, and so you'd want to use one that's a pet safe enema, and they do sell them. And, you know, we do enemas at the vet school. It's not our favorite thing to do by any means, but it gets them unplugged and back on the, you know, I'm able to eat and drink and feel better. And I would bet that that's why your cat was probably vomiting. Having that colon stretched that much with that much fecal material in it can trigger nausea, and then they don't want to eat and may even start vomiting too. So I'm so glad that you've got this under control, but it's one of the common complications that we see in kitties with kidney disease. And absolutely no problem with using Benefiber. I've just found that not every cat would like to eat it. And that, you know, when I say Miralax, you can sometimes use that in a smaller volume. But if that is working for your cat, perfectly safe to use. So you, your husband and your cat can share the same bottle. Here you go.
All right. Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it. Mary in Madison, what's on your mind?
Yeah, this involves a pre-animal control situation.
Okay.
I took in, my neighbor wanted me to take in a stray for the night. She had called animal control, but they couldn't pick the animal up, the cat up, until 9 in the morning. So I kept it overnight, and I fed it some milk. And I was wondering, is that all right for cats and milk?
It really depends. Some cats are lactose intolerant, just like some people are, and it can cause them to have some gastrointestinal upset from it. I would have preferred that you went to your local grocery store and got something yummy that is in the pet food aisle to be able to give them, rather than milk from your refrigerator. But, you know, in a pinch, if the cat wasn't drinking water, you may have a few days of diarrhea afterwards, but I think that, you know, you did okay for dealing with the stray, but I think just straight water and some commercial cat food probably would have been a better choice to be able to give your cat, the cat, or even just some human tuna, in a pinch. But you would not want to use that long term, obviously, because it's not well balanced. But if you're just looking for some nutrition to be able to get in the cat, some cooked chicken, canned tuna, something like that would have been probably fine. May still cause some GI upset. So back to your question, is milk okay? It all depends on the cat. And you didn't know this cat well enough to be able to know how well his gut handles it.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Diane in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. Hey, thanks for taking our call, Doctor. My question is this. My male dog is about 3.5, and he's been on Apoquel now for about 1.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an incredible drug because he was just going crazy licking, and just he was just obsessed with licking and going, you know.
Yeah.
Getting his fur. Well, my question is, okay, he's been on this drug, and I'm wondering what is the psychiatric or psychological impact of this drug? The dog before was totally obsessed. Now I tried to wean him off it just to see if I could get him off it, if his symptoms might have, you know, gotten mm-hmm. a little bit better. And in doing so, he just seemed to get almost like he was coming off heroin or something. I mean, he was so depressed. He didn't want to go outside. It was just really impacted his brain.
Well, I've not seen anything like that before. What Apoquil does is it's a Jak kinase inhibitor, which is one of these like neurochemicals that are involved in the itch cycle. And we do use it long term, and we have people stop and start it, especially if their dog has seasonal allergies. The downside with stopping and starting it is that when you initially, even if you just have a few days break from it, you have to go back to using it twice a day for a couple of weeks and then drop back to the once a day. One of the things you may want to look into, though, is there's a newer medication on the market that is, it's called Cytopoint, C-Y-T-O-P-O-I-N-T. It's an injectable drug that neutralizes another kind of neurochemical called interleukin 31 that is the big key ingredient in the itch cycle. It's given by injection. It lasts for 30 to 60 days, depending on the dog, and it would be done at your vet clinic. And so I have not seen any dogs that are, I've had many dogs that are on Apoquil long term, have never had problems like your dog has had. I'm just wondering if he got so depressed because his skin started to bother him again. And
he's been on it. When I cut him just to a half a dose for a couple of days, but he just was so lethargic. But my question is, are either of these drugs immunosuppressant drugs?
No. That's the nice thing about using them. In the past, we had to use drugs like prednisone, different steroids that are going to suppress the immune system, thin the skin, and cause problems. That way, these particular ones, whether it's the Cytopoint, which is given by injection, or Apoquil, actually work on the nerves and are not involved with suppressing the immune system. So they're very safe for long-term use.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have some cool photos coming up. We'll be able to talk about them in just a minute. Oh, my goodness. There's some funny shots here. And we'll do that. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather. Our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Post your photo at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we will be back with Sandy right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. We have lots of great photos on our Facebook page, and the one that just popped up was from Connor, who brought this kitty a few months ago. The previous owner thought it was a Maine Coon. Are you able to tell from the photo whether or not it is?
I can't. By just looking at the photo, Maine Coons are the giant breed cat in the cat world, and they usually have long hair and are quite large. I had somebody in the other day with a long-haired cat and said, we think it's Maine Coon because of the long hair, and I had to burst their bubble and say, it's probably just a domestic cat because Maine Coons are a purebred cat, and it would probably come with a family tree with who the parents were and so on, and people that breed Maine Coons are going to be following up that way, and so I probably not, but it's a cute little kitten anyway. So.
It sure is, and here is one of the coolest photos from Ellie, who is the Buddy Meatball, our rescue pit bull, looking straight at the camera with, what's it wearing, a sweater?
Well, he's got not only his sweater on, because he came from Alabama, and so he's not used to Wisconsin winters, and then he has a big snoot or turtleneck keeping his ears warm, and he's sitting in front of the fireplace, so this poor southern dog is in for a shock if we get cold weather back again. Yeah.
And there are some others. We'll get to those in a bit here, but here's a question from Dick in Reedsburg. Dick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, my son's dog, which I kind of co-raised from a puppy, and I'd keep her for 6 weeks and he'd have her. And she'd grow. Anyways, starting at a very young age, she got really attached to us. Very excitable dog. Every time we see her now and have forever, every time we go to visit her or she comes to visit us, She gets so excited, she pees all over the floor.
Oh, you know, and this is so common in dogs. And in fact, my own dog does this every once in a while. He just gets so excited. There's certain people that he, and one of my dogs, whenever his previous owner, who was the breeder, comes to our house, he just loses it and just whittles everywhere. And this is, it's very involuntary. The worst thing you can do is punish them, because that's just going to make it worse. I would strongly recommend that you do your greeting outside, that, you know, not get the dog super excited. Maybe consider squatting down and being down at the dog's level, and avoiding direct eye contact, using a soft voice so that you're not, you know, winding this dog up. And some of these dogs, just greeting them that way may improve their confidence a little bit, and then they may not leak as much. But doing it outside, your best bet. Then you don't have to worry about cleanup. Yeah.
There you go, Dick. Thank you for calling. Oh, boy. Corey in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Corey.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 4.5-year-old lab who generally healthy, and he has developed severe anxiety at night. Let's just say between when it gets dark and, you know, like 5:30, between then and bedtime, which can be anywhere between, you know, 10:30 and 11:30 at night. He shakes severely. He whines and cries and barks. He wants to be out of the house.
Huh.
And he will, if you let him outside, he will just curl up in a ball and lay outside the garage door. Or if you let him in the garage, that's another place warm where he's comfortable, and he just lays down there. And he'll spend, and this just started in the last 4 to 5 years.
Very weird. Very weird.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah, you know, I had a father and son team come in not too long ago with a dog that, you know, you come into the vet clinic and the dog was a little nervous and was trembling and shaking. And the little boy said, look at that. You know, Bo is shaking just like when mommy cooks. And I'm like, what? And it turns out one time when mom was cooking dinner, something set the smoke alarm off, and that triggered the dog's anxiety. So now that every time anybody even walks towards the stove or looks like they're going to be cooking something, the dog has a panic attack.
Ugh.
And so I don't know what triggered your dog to be like this at this particular time, whether it was an incident that happened in the house, like a smoke alarm going off, or who knows what it was. And sometimes we can never determine what's triggering this. I would definitely talk to your veterinarian about considering having your dog started on some form of an anti-anxiety drug. Minimal would be to put one of these DAP or dog appeasement pheromone collars on your dog. May help, but it won't hurt. So, it's worth trying. But it sounds like your dog is bad enough that you may need some, you know, therapy that's going to be prescription medication to be able to get your dog more comfortable. And this would also be something we're working with a applied animal behaviorist that can teach you how to desensitize your dog to things in the house. And it may mean starting in the garage with the dog being comfortable and relaxed out there, maybe with the garage door open, and you know, just very, very slowly getting this dog back into the house again, where it can, you know, maybe have a floor mat or something where it feels comfortable, and you gradually move it further in the house. But, you know, this would be something that obviously is going to take some help from a professional. But I think medication is going to help speed things along quite well for your dog.
There we go.
Excellent. All right. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Thanks for calling. And Kathleen in Indianapolis, Indiana, it is your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, Larry. And hi, Dr. Sawchuk.
Hi.
We have a 6.5-year-old English Mastiff. This is actually kind of a shaking question, too, but completely different subject. We've noticed now maybe 3 or 4 times a week, he'll be lying on his side, not sleeping, he's awake, but his back leg is trembling, kind of shaking, trembling. And we're just wondering if that's a early indication of something maybe more serious health concern. Should I have that checked out?
Yes, I definitely would. I mean, as a 6-year-old dog for that particular breed, that he's a senior citizen.
And, oh, I know.
And so common things that could cause a leg to tremble would be just the leg being stressed because he has arthritis or some other orthopedic issue that is making that leg a little more uncomfortable for him. Kind of like, when I've gone to the gym and overdo it on a piece of equipment, I'll get to that point where my arms or my legs will actually be shaking a little bit. Mm-hmm. That may be what's going on with him. But there can sometimes be other more serious things that can cause tremors, things like low calcium levels, even high calcium levels. We mentioned this earlier in the show. It could be a neurologic issue if he's got some back issues or something where he may have a pinched nerve and it's causing some discomfort. And so getting him in for a good physical exam, maybe a little bit of blood work. If they're thinking that this is pain-related, secondary to osteoarthritis, that blood work would be helpful to know what kind of medication we could put your dog on. Because some of them are, we have to be careful if the dog has any underlying liver or kidney disease, we wouldn't want to use them. So I think that's a great idea to get your dog in to have him looked at and have a good senior physical done.
Okay, I will call my vet right away.
All right. Thanks, Kathleen, for calling. Just back to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show here for just a second. Cindy sent a photo of Jake, the retriever of birds. Now, isn't that a beautiful...
What an artistic photo. Mist in the background and that, birdhouse, which it's probably a wood duck house, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, or could something. Well be. It
or
looks
maybe
like
a bluebird house?
Could
I'm
be
not sure.
It's a wood duck,
wood
I think.
Wood duck, okay. But, oh, what a gorgeous lab. And it looks like he just got out of the water, too. Look at that.
Just a regal-looking
animal.
So
that probably was not taken right now because the water's a little hard these days.
I love that photo. And then one more I'll mention right at the moment. Karen sent one of Jesse at Devil's Lake in December.
If it wasn't for the fact that this dog has a black mask on its face, he's wearing a red coat too, but he would just blend right in. Talk about camouflage in the winter because the rest of his body is all white.
A very cool picture. Thanks for sending those. Deanna in Bayfield has something for us. Hi, Deanna.
Hello. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 3-year-old Basset Hound whose name is Rudy, and we took him to the vet because he started to drool excessively. His breath got very stinky, and he started licking the air. It tends to get worse at night. And also gulping as if he's, trying to keep something down. So after quite a bit of blood work and whatever, my vet told me that he had heartburn or acid reflux.
Mm-hmm.
She eliminated just about everything else. He's young, he's healthy in every other way. What would you recommend to treat this?
Yeah, the signs that you're showing, I just had a bulldog in yesterday that presented with very similar type symptoms with just licking the air, acting a little nauseous, and we were thinking that this is probably some type of a reflux problem as well. And so what I would be recommending is talking to your veterinarian about using some type of an antacid, either something like Prilosec, which you can get over the counter. And we do use that very safely in dogs. We sometimes change the dose, and sometimes in dogs we'll use it, even though it's a once-a-day drug for people. There are times where we do use it twice a day if we're thinking that the dog has inflammation of its esophagus or esophagitis, and that can happen with heartburn. When we get... That's what's causing when we have heartburn. It's because our esophagus is irritated. And so that would be something to consider putting your dog on kind of long term. You may also want to look at feeding schedules and making sure that your dog maybe instead of eating two meals a day, maybe eating three or four meals to allow food to always be in the stomach to keep things going through. That's helped some of these dogs as well.
Well, he will love that.
There you go.
Okay, and do I keep him on the Prilosec just about all the time, or?
Yes, I mean, this may be something that's just a temporary thing. It could be permanent for him.
Okay.
One thing that we've seen is sometimes dogs that are overweight can have more issues with this because they've got all that pressure from their abdomen, especially if they're laying down, will force stuff from the stomach up into their esophagus. And so, and Bassets are not the most active dog, and I've seen quite a few that get overweight. So if he has a weight issue, that would be one thing to be working on as well, as getting that extra weight off of him.
Yeah, actually, he's quite athletic and very... he's perfect in terms of his weight. And
wonderful.
Oh, good.
He wonderful.
He runs and plays, and we just love him. He's so active. So.
Good, good.
Okay, well, I have been giving him something once a day, but maybe twice a day might be a better...
Yeah, you may need something like that. And I've just had better luck with over-the-counter Prilosec than I have with things like Pepcid. And so I'm not sure which one your dog is on, if they're on something like that, but it may mean just changing what you're using as an antacid
and
as well.
Should I try changing his food?
Maybe making it a little more digestible,
okay,
so that it empties out of the stomach a little bit better. I don't know if your veterinarian did any other diagnostic work that would involve taking x-rays, but we do see some dogs that have, and I, being a bulldog owner, I think of this with bulldogs, not so much with Bassets, but they can have sliding hiatal hernias as well, where some of their stomach may be going up into the chest cavity and back in again, causing some nausea. So I don't know if your veterinarian's equipped for doing a barium swallow and fluoroscopy. That usually takes some pretty special equipment. But sometimes having that done as a the diagnostic test to see, do we have stomach contents refluxing back into the esophagus, or do we have something that we can surgically repair, like a hiatal hernia, which is where the stomach passes through the diaphragm into the chest cavity.
There
okay.
We go.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure Rudy will appreciate that.
Well, good
luck. Right. Thanks, Deanna. Greg in Madison, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Dr. Sandy. Thank you. I have a senior cat that I'm calling it a broken purr box, but when she purrs, it sounds broken. And it's gotten to the point where it causes her to struggle to breathe a little.
How old is your cat?
Oh, I'm going to say 17, 18 years old.
Okay. All right. So not a young kitty. Yeah. Yeah.
No. Uh-uh.
So I worry when we have voice change like that or purring change. Is there something anatomically going on back in the cat's larynx or where the sounds are actually originating from? And it's things like a tumor, laryngeal paralysis, where the vocal cords just hang, tends to be more of a dog problem than a cat problem. But at this age, I would be thinking that there's something structurally wrong there that's triggering this. And, having your cat either like radiographs done of the neck and the larynx area may help if there's a mass there that you could see. A light plane of anesthesia and a laryngeal exam may be helpful as well. So it kind of depends on the health of your cat and how well they would tolerate having some of these procedures done. But yeah, an older cat that has a voice change like that, there's something medically going on that needs to be evaluated.
So don't just live with it.
Live with it. I would think getting it evaluated would be in your cat's best interest.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Back to our Facebook page for a moment. There's a photo here Stacy sent, and she says, this little man, what a cute little guy, must a gray and white something or other dog.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little terrier of some kind, it looks like, yeah.
She says this little man must have reflux, too. His symptoms are identical to the previous caller. He's about 10 pounds. What kind of doses of Prilosec do you start with?
We usually start, and because as veterinarians, we tend to dose everything in kilograms, so we usually use a half to one milligram per kilogram once a day. And so because this is a human medication, that little guy, probably you'd be looking at a 10 milligram tablet and using a half of a 10 milligram tablet would be the maximum amount you would want to use, maybe even as low as a quarter of a 10 milligram tablet once a day.
All right, there we go. Jason in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Larry. Hi, Sandy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a nine-year-old Beagle Chow, and he's full of life. He's happy. But the problem that I have is that when he plays and he starts exercising, it doesn't take but maybe 2 or 3 minutes before he's got to kind of stop. And it's like he's coughing up a hairball, but what he's actually doing is he's spitting up almost like a white, foamy kind of pukey substance. And usually he'll do that once, and he'll get a decent amount out, but then he'll run around a little more. And then he'll stop and he'll do it again. Sometimes he'll do it 2 or 3 times. So I'm not sure if it's related to the earlier conversation about acid reflux, but I'm just curious if it might be something with the food that we've got him on, because it doesn't seem to, you know, debilitate his ability to play. He's still happy and he still wants to run around. He's got lots of energy. It's just that he's got to stop and do that frequently.
Yeah, have you had chest x-rays done?
Have I had what?
Chest radiographs or x-rays done of his thorax?
I have not. I had him inspected about a month ago because he had a fatty tumor growing on his stomach, and
uh-huh.
They did blood work, and everything came back normal. She said it was just a lipoma, so that was
good.
That was good.
Good.
But other than that, we haven't done any x-rays or anything.
Okay. I mean, if this is something that is this a new problem for him, or is it something that that he's had all his life?
As long as I've had him, it seems like he's always sort of had this issue. And I've tried changing out to different foods without corn or grain or anything like that. He's on candidate all life stages. So it doesn't seem to matter. You know, we've always kind of had this issue with him.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I worry when we have a dog that has a productive cough with exercise, we always want to get heart disease off the table. And so that's where a stethoscope applied to his chest, which I hope your veterinarian did, to have a listen to the heart to make sure that your dog doesn't have any murmurs or abnormalities that way. Listening to the lung fields to see if there's any crackles or wheezes there that could be a problem. He may have some like chronic bronchitis or something like that. And sometimes we can actually see changes in the lung fields on the x-rays. In rare cases, we do see dogs that have lung cancer that can be causing some, you know, coughing. Usually it's going to be a progressive type thing. It's not something that they just have all the time. But I think going back, if your veterinarian has not done a good thorough chest evaluation with their ears and then getting a chest x-ray, would definitely recommend doing that as first thing to do, because we've got to just make sure there's nothing serious going on in there.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Margaret in Buchanan, hello.
Hi. I have a 9-year-old poodle, standard poodle, who's about 70 pounds, and his right knee is going. And his left knee went 2 years ago, and we did a TPL or whichever that one was. But now that he's 9, he's more than probably a candidate for surgery because, you know, his ligament's going again, the other one.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just concerned if at his age, if he would respond to surgery as well as he did 2 years ago when he was 7.
Well, yeah. I like to say that age isn't a disease, because if somebody came to me and said, hey, you're 60, you know, forget about having something fixed, you know, I really think that's unfair to the dog. He could go on to have a very long life. I mean, we tend to see standard poodles live into their teens. 12, 13, 14. Not uncommon to see that. And so rather than having him be uncomfortable in his senior years, if his lab work and body the rest of his physical comes back okay and he's a good candidate for anesthesia, and especially if you're able to work postoperatively with a good physical therapist to be able to get him under control, I think he's a great candidate to have that fixed.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Sandy, we are out of time, and there's so many nice photos up here. So I hope you have a chance to go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Oh, some nice kitties and dogs.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
A lot of happy ones. And you'll be back February 28th.
I will be at the end of the month.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.